Okay, if I could have your attention, please. If you could take your seats rather soon. Welcome, everybody. I'm James Putzel. I'm the director of the Crisis States Research Center. And I'm going to be chairing this afternoon's panel. It's a slightly different event than we normally have in relationship to the visiting lecture series at Destin. It's co-organized by Destin, the Crisis States Research Center, and Chatham House. And I want to particularly thank Stéphane Dubois of Chatham House for all the hard work that she's put into organizing this activity. We're very lucky today to have quite a distinguished panel who are going to debate issues that are crucial in development today around the role of business. What's the role of business in development? And we're going to discuss the case of coffee production in Ethiopia. We have with us Hilary Parsons, who's head of corporate affairs of Nestle Corporation, and she'll be talking to the very recent launching of a new brand of coffee, instant coffee from Nescafe, which is called Partners Blend, and this has a fair trademark. This is I think the very first time one of the major big four coffee producers has taken up and been accorded by the Fair Trade Foundation the fair trade mark on some portion of their production. We have Constantino Casabuenes, who's a policy advisor at Oxfam, who has dealt with trade issues. I was looking him up on the internet the other day, and he has a distinguished record of policy advocacy and policy research. We have Dr., and I'm giving you the order of presentation as well, Dr. Haile Gebretseyi, who is Deputy Director of the Ethiopian Economic Policy Research Institute, who's going to talk to us more about the overall situation of coffee production and coffee producers in Ethiopia, and Dr. Muzong Kodi, who's an Associate Fellow at Chatham House, who is particularly interested in roles of business and development and the way that business may be able to confront patterns of corruption. Now, the issue of trade and development is a very hot one. We're going to be focusing in on a very narrow slice of the debate today, but an extremely important one. 2 years ago, when Ethiopia was facing, like many other coffee producers around the developing world, a sharp decline in international coffee prices, we saw massive implications for poverty in the rural areas. At that time, I read recently that coffee earnings had been making up to almost 70% of GDP in Ethiopia, though I want this to be corroborated, corrected, or whatever, by our eminent scholar from Ethiopia. But I understand that in just 5 years' time, up to 2003, the contribution of coffee earnings had fell to only 35%. That meant that a major source of earnings was lost to Ethiopia as a state, and certainly to Ethiopian farmers. Farmers at the time were ripping up coffee trees and planting a drug, an amphetamine crop that was earning officially almost a third of what coffee earnings were at the time in 2003. So these are very, very real issues. Producers face a vacillating primary commodity markets, and these have important impacts. At the time in 2003, Nestle was one of the big buyers in Ethiopia, and while it was taking some initiatives in the context of the crisis in coffee prices, at the same time I noted that Oxfam had issued a major criticism to Nestle for not buying fair trade coffee at the time. So now we see a situation has come about that's really rather different. And so I'm interested in hearing the perspectives of both the Nestle Corporation and Oxfam on these developments, and in exploring this subject in relationship to the bigger question of corporate social responsibility and what that means today to challenges for development. So I won't prolong my talks any longer. We're going to have 10-minute presentations from each of the speakers. I'll give them a minute each to respond to one another if they'd like to, and we go immediately to the floor, and I ask you to be your normal selves, challenging, raising questions. If you have points to make, and I'll repeat this again in a moment when it's your turn to speak, make them concisely, and let's have a really good and vigorous debate. Thank you. So, Hillary Parsons.
First of all, thank you, Chair, and thank you all for the opportunity to offer a perspective on this very important issue, the role of business in development, the case of coffee production in Ethiopia. My own background is very much a practical one. I've been in the fortunate position of being directly involved in a coffee project in Ethiopia on behalf of Nestle for the past 2 to 3 years, and I'm privileged to have actually visited the country on several occasions. I'm going to start by making a few remarks about the interests that we as a multinational business have in global trade issues, and also the role that trade and investment can play as tools for development. I will then say something about our coffee activities in general, and then specifically the work we are doing in Ethiopia. Nestle is the world's largest food and drink company, and we've been in existence for nearly 140 years. We have factories located in more than 80 countries, and we've been established in the developing world for over 75 years, with some 45% of our factories and 48% of our employees based there. Some people hold the view that businesses, and multinational corporations in particular, win at the expense of the poor, particularly in the developing world. However, the reality is somewhat different, and as this expert audience will know, many studies have shown that trade can help bring people out of poverty. For example, poor countries who were open to international trade grew 6 times faster in the 70s and 80s than those who kept their markets closed. Trade can't solve all the world's ills, but it can help raise living standards and provide the money for governments to invest in healthcare, education, and other core services. A strong economy can equal a strong society. Nestlé are supporters of market liberalisation, and we believe that a freer trade system can deliver a fair and just global trading system. But it must be backed up by simultaneous initiatives to help farmers in developing countries participate effectively in any newly opened markets. For example, we would like to see an increase in aid for rural development, which has decreased by about a third over the past decade. Turning now to coffee, Nestle has been directly working with coffee farmers for over 30 years, when the first Nestle agronomist began work in the field. Today we have many programs and activities underway in 14 different countries, and this map shows some examples. These range from our direct purchasing scheme, which operates in 7 coffee-producing countries, and enables farmers to retain more of the value of the coffee, to technical assistance for farmers to help them improve quality and hence improve their income. We also support diversification projects to help farmers find other sources of income in addition to coffee. In addition, over half of all Nescafe is produced in the developing world, which enables those economies to retain the added value. In recent years, there has been overproduction of coffee, which sent coffee bean prices to very low levels, although prices have rallied of late. This problem of fluctuating prices causes real problems for smallholder coffee farmers in particular, some of whom are totally reliant on their crop for their main source of income. Nestlé believes a sustainable approach to coffee production can help farmers cope better in today's marketplace. We have therefore been increasingly focusing our support around the three pillars of sustainability: social, economic, and environmental. We have co-founded the Sustainable Agriculture Initiative platform of the Food Industry, SAI platform, and have a number of projects underway, including in Ethiopia, in order to develop this approach further with a view to feeding these findings into our mainstream operations. We are also an active member of the 4C, that's the common code for the coffee community, and this is an all-stakeholder voluntary group working to define the minimum conditions for sustainable coffee growing. Nestlé also supports the Sustainable Coffee Partnership, or SCP, where stakeholders meet to exchange views. Now, Nestlé does not have any direct operations in Ethiopia. We have no employees based there and no infrastructure of our own, such as factories, and our product sales in Ethiopia are relatively modest. For over 2 years, however, we have been working with smallholder coffee farmers in Ethiopia, providing investment, assistance, technical training, and tools to help the farmers help themselves, their communities, and the environment. In Ethiopia, coffee producers are mainly smallholders who have been assigned the use of a small piece of land, which they generally do not own, by the government. Nestlé does not actually produce any coffee of its own in Ethiopia. Coffee production, processing, and export is restricted to local private sector business and the cooperative unions. No foreign investments or participation is allowed. However, we do purchase coffee from Ethiopia and are also undertaking the work mentioned earlier with smallholder coffee farmers in the Yirgacheffe region of Ethiopia. The area comprises 8 villages called Kebeles in the Gedio zone Kochere-Wereda, with a population of almost 40,000 people, and 43% are children. We established our project, which is based upon the three pillars of sustainability, economic, social, environment, around a small coffee cherry washing station owned by a local private Ethiopian company, Mulege. We have imported washing equipment from South America, which has many environmental advantages. It uses much less water and does not contaminate the rivers, for example. And we paid for an engineer to be based at the washing station for a number of months in order to oversee the installation and train local people in its use. We also provide technical assistance to the farmers through the employment of an agronomist and have installed a clean water supply system for the local community, who formerly had to fetch their drinking water from polluted rivers. Farmers also receive a second payment for their coffee on top of the price they are paid for the cherries. Here are some typical scenes of the project area. We are now working with the Fair Trade Labelling Organisation International with a view to these farmers receiving fair trade certification. In addition, we purchase coffee from an existing fair trade certified cooperative, the Oromia Cooperative Union, whose beans are used in our first fair trade certified product mentioned earlier, Nescafe Partners Blend. We are also developing sustainability project work with Oromia and will in fact be visiting them next month when we travel out to Ethiopia. This slide shows the washing station around which the project work is actually based, and again, another typical scene. Now, I recognise that these are small steps in terms of our global operations, but we do believe they are significant. As a business, we recognise that helping to improve the capabilities of farmers in Ethiopia can also be in our own long-term commercial interests. We also recognise that the consumer is increasingly concerned about whether the coffee they drink has been cultivated in a manner which respects local communities and the environment, and that the farmers have received a fair price. But such a commitment to helping farmers be productive and successful must be sustainable and for the long term. And at Nestlé, we are increasingly making and taking decisions in that context. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Constantino Casabuenes from Oxfam.
see if I find my way here. Okay, that's it. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Let me see, in these 10 minutes, I just want to explain what we have learned in that relation between business and development with the experience that we have had during the last 4 years in the campaigning experience with Oxfam and with many partner organizations. We started the campaign with this title, "What is that in your coffee?" Because we got the feeling that where we went, if you go to Starbucks here around the corner, you will find that, I just went, I paid $1.90 for a cappuccino, and guess how, which percentage of that $1.90 get the small producer? Less than 0.5%. And they are somehow the ones who are creating the possibility for this shop to exist here and in I don't know how many countries. So we decided to give the title, this lemma, this "What is that in your coffee?" And we have understood that coffee is impossible to analyze it, to consider it as a commodity alone. It is part of all the trade regulations controlled by the WTO. So it's not possible to analyze coffee economy isolated. Let's see. In the campaign, when we think about development, for us development is basically accomplishment, fulfillment of human rights, be them economic, social, cultural, civil or political rights. And what we are trying to do with the our work and what we think an organization like Oxfam or other development organizations should be doing is based on moral standards and on international standards to see which are the responsibilities at all levels, from the individuals to the international, be it public or private. And then we include in that, in all those levels indicated here, companies, governments, individuals, communities, all different types of organizations. So what we have done as campaign is to integrate program, work, policy, and public campaigning. And we, in the case of Ethiopia, we have been working with some of the organizations Hillary was mentioning, Jirga Shefe, Sidamo, Oromia. In every case, we are talking about unions involving between 40,000 to 70,000 producers, each one. And they are part of the 25 million producers all over the world who are responsible for producing more or less 75% of the whole market. So you can imagine 75% of the entire market is produced by small-scale producers. The other important point is that in this relation with these key actors at the top level, ICO, UN, governments, transnational companies, big business, resulting from the 20, 30 years of liberalization of structural adjustment programs, we find that in the case of coffee, the whole market is concentrated, more than 70% of the market is concentrated in four companies. And then we find somehow that we are playing the interests of four companies who have to respond to the shareholders and the interest of 25 million people who are very poor and are getting poorer because of the fall in the coffee price. And it's a very difficult task to try to balance both. What we have seen here is that when we try, this is, I want to concentrate the attention on this slide, which is in white, yeah? It's blank. And I want to characterize very briefly how we understand the coffee market in order to find solutions which could be considered as such solutions for the producers. First of all, you have green coffee, the coffee beans, and you have beverages and soluble coffee, which are completely different things, different products. And for that reason, we are putting them in the two extremes of the slide. The market during the last 4 years, during the times of the crisis, is moving towards buyer-driven market. So we here as consumers are defining what will happen with the 25 million people. On the left side, you have, I would like to devote much more time to this, but you have several, in a way, you could call them vicious cycles, yeah, involving, first of all, say, supply, demand. We generate profits, generate reinvestment of the business, generates bigger capacity, generates efficiency, yeah? And you have on the other side, in the side of beverages and soluble coffee, the same variables, but operating in a completely different environment, which has to do more with a different type of establishing the price. And the way that the price is established has to do with the speculative investment, has to do with capacity in the north being projected in capacity in the south on some industries, not on all. And you have the demand happening in London or in New York conditioning what can be paid to small-scale producers selling cherries. Ethiopians are selling cherries. They are not selling processed coffee. And then we have a problem there. And we have a problem because on the left side, and on the left side you have Ethiopia with some of the best coffee beans in the world, but soft currency, high vulnerability, high dependence, no possibility to diversify because of the trading rules, closely associated with power and with conflict dynamics. On the right side, you have companies dealing with intangibles, with ideas, with prestige. Hard currency, stable, defined market governance, defined contents of quality, and defines what means sustainability. Very simply, this slide to explain what happened with the fall with the coffee price, if you compare 92 with 2002, the participation of the producer countries in the coffee market was 30%. It fell to 10%. And in the case of Ethiopia, the falling price was from $57 to $17 per ton. In the case of Ethiopia, the figure I got is 64% of all exports correspond to coffee. You can imagine the impact of the falling price. And what does it mean for the possibilities for social policies, for reinvestment, for Ethiopia moving around the world? What has happened with the campaign? The campaign involving actors, involving alliances, involving all these unions. What we have managed to do is to generate some awareness on what is happening in Ethiopia. Massive postcards and email actions on the four giants, the four big roasters. Strengthen assertiveness of Ethiopian organizations, developing civil society. Over 4 million signatures in Ethiopia have expressed their will to join the campaign, and they have joined in different ways of mobilizations. A special declaration by the Prime Minister trying to influence the annual shareholder meeting of Nestlé. We have done some research on Nestlé in Mexico and Brazil to understand how the business operates all over the world. And we have found some, I would say, achievements in the sense of Nestlé accepting to give up the claim they made from the Ethiopian government on $6 million U.S. dollars corresponding to a plant that was privatized. And we see Nestlé's partners blend, already presented by Hillary, as a first and very small step in the right direction. But it's a small first step. And we would like to understand where it is leading to, what will happen after that first step. And for us, it's important that fair trade coffee, the fair trade coffee market is growing, keeps growing, and in this particular case, with Nestlé, or with this brand being certified, it means an increase for the fair trade market. But our evaluation is, we want to see. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now, Dr. Tay.
Okay.
Click on this
one here. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to say a few words about Chatham for inviting me to make this speech. First, before I go to coffee production, I'd like to set the stage by saying a few words about the private sector in Ethiopia. First, it's very weak and fragile, mainly for historical reasons. The share of the private sector in the economy is very small, mainly engaged in the informal sector. Some estimates say about 50% of the economy is in the informal sector, which the coffee production is part of that activity. It has improved relatively in recent years because of government efforts, but still it has a long way to go. The possible reasons why the private sector is weak and fragile is partly for policy reasons, or what we call the lack of enabling environment for the private sector to grow. The second is lack of agglomeration economies, to use the economic jargon, or what it means is it simply is not attractive enough for the private sector because of the linkages with other activities. A third reason is weak foreign direct investment flow. All these factors contributed to the weak contribution of the private sector. Now, the coffee sector in Ethiopia, in terms of its economic role, it contributes about 60% to total exports, export revenue, not to GDP. It's much smaller in terms of GDP. It's just, but as a commodity, it's probably the most important commodity in terms of export revenue. Ethiopia is dependent for its export revenue primarily on coffee, since about 65 to, as you said, about 64% is also sometimes 70%, depending on the season. In terms of dependence, it's second to Brazil in terms of being dependent on exports for its revenue. It employs about 25% of the workforce. Even though in terms of its contribution to the world supply of coffee, which is about 3%, it is the second largest exporter in Africa, following Côte d'Ivoire. And in terms of the variant of the Arabica coffee, it's the largest exporter in Africa. Now, what's the production structure? Mainly produced by small farmers, about 90% of coffee production. The rest is produced by private sector and government enterprises. Annually, it is estimated on average about 200,000 to 250,000 metric tons is produced in Ethiopia. Out of this, about 35% is used for local consumption, while the remaining is exported. It's predominantly produced in the southern and eastern half of the country. Coffee being indigenous to Ethiopia, some of the plant is growing as wild plants in Ethiopia, which accounts about 33% as wild plant, while most of it is deliberately grown by farmers. Now, in terms of distribution of what is produced, even though there are some initiatives by the government in recent years to organize themselves in various cooperatives and farmers' associations, they mainly sell to local intermediaries. The middle traders bring the supply to the local auction markets, there are two local auction markets in two different cities. But due to poor infrastructure, fragmented markets, and lack of storage, each farmer cannot access the main auction markets. Consequently, the gap between what we call the gate prices, or what the farmers get, and the prices that prevail at the auction market have a huge gap. Following the price collapse, the government is encouraging farmers to form cooperatives and farmers' associations to directly sell their output, either to the local or the global market, improve the quality of processing and storage facilities to enable them to market their produce, help farmers to improve quality via extension packages, and also encouraging farmers to improve the quality by making it and sell it as an organic plant. Now, if you just to see just some of the price changes, coffee prices, as other speakers have already mentioned, it has decreased significantly whether you see it as a unit value or as a growth rate of the value of exports that has prevailed. Especially in the last 5 years, the coffee price index has decreased from about 133.1 as an index to about 51.9, almost by 50%. Well, by more than 50%, really. Due to the reduction following the price collapse, coffee prices recovered slightly between 2003 and 2004, but still it hasn't reached what it has lost in the after 1998. If you look again in terms of what is happening to the quantity produced and the value that it's fetching in the both in the auction market and the international markets, there is a significant difference in the last 5 to 7 years in terms of the overall price of coffee. In terms of the Ethiopian coffee, what is happening is, one, compared to the price of imports, the terms of trade has significantly deteriorated, or this has led to what's called the unequal exchange in terms of what Ethiopia imports and the value of those imports and what it exports, which is the price of coffee predominantly. And therefore, the terms of trade has been against Ethiopia, as it is for many primary commodity exporting countries. Essentially then, both in terms of the quantity that is sold outside and the price that it's getting for its exports has significantly increased, with all the implications in terms of revenue that could have been used for education and health services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. Now I call on Dr. Cody from Chatham House. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've been asked to look at how corruption can have an impact on the role of business in development, and also reflect on how business can contribute to fighting corruption in developing countries and also in the developed countries, for that matter. Why, you would wonder, would we be interested in corruption while we're talking about Ethiopia and the role of business in the development of this country? The main reason is that corruption plays havoc with all the efforts that are made in development. Corruption has extensive damaging effects on the economies of the third world. And corruption can make it very difficult for businesses to actually contribute positively to the development of a particular country. The case under review shows clearly how business can contribute to furthering the development of a particular country. The scheme is still very new, but it shows potential for quite a great deal of impact if it's replicated in many other places. For a long time, it was believed that corporations exist solely to make profit for their shareholders. What mattered, therefore, was a profitable bottom line. In recent years, there have been changes in ways in which people look at the role of business in the economy. There's a sense of a wider responsibility being given to business, not only responsibility to their own shareholders, but also to customers and clients, and beyond to the communities and societies at large in which they operate. This was mainly due to the work of organizations like Oxfam and the others who were putting pressure on the multinationals to change the way they relate to the societies and communities in which they work. In the particular case of coffee, the liberalization of the economies of the world, the third world, under pressure from the IMF and the World Bank, led to a transformation of third world markets in the sense that before this change, the coffee sector was dominated by coffee marketing boards controlled by governments. With the liberalization of the market, the corporations were given a major role in the economies. The marketing boards no longer had a role in determining the price of coffee. It was the free market that determined the price of coffee. This, as you can see, is an additional responsibility for businesses working in the third world because of the added importance that they have in the economies of this world. In response to this additional responsibility and to the greater role that corporations had in the economies of the third world, it was felt important to set some standards for corporate conduct, especially when dealing in the developing world. And one of the areas that was of most interest to civil society organizations was the area of governance, but also the fight against corruption. A number of initiatives have been taken at the international level, and they include, just to go very quickly, we don't have the time to elaborate on this, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, of the British government, the UN Global Compact, the business principles of Transparency International, the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. Why does business have a role in the fight against corruption? What can they do? How can they tackle this corruption? Now, corruption, as far as businesses are concerned, has the perverse consequence of adding to the cost of the operational costs of the enterprises. It also has an effect of making the economic environment in which the companies operate rather unstable and unpredictable. And as we have seen in many areas in Africa, unethical behavior on the part of corporations has led and is still fueling a number of conflicts. You've seen that in the diamond mining sector. You see that in the gold and also in the timber sectors. A country like Ethiopia is really marked and has a lot to do in terms of fighting corruption, and that can have quite an impact on the businesses operating in such a country. According to the latest edition of the Corruption Perception Index, Ethiopia scored 2.2 out of a clean score of 10, and it was classified 137th out of the 159 countries that were classified by Transparency International. 2.2 out of 10 indicates rampant corruption, and this means that all sectors of the society are marked by corruption. Corruption is found in all the operations in this particular country. The Ethiopian government themselves have acknowledged the importance of fighting against corruption. They inherited, when they took the current regime, inherited a situation where corruption was very rampant, and they set up in 2001 the Federal Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission, charged with the responsibility of fighting against corruption. A number of things have been done in the fight against corruption, but they still, according to the latest reports, corruption still remains a major issue because the commission doesn't have the capacity nor the experience of fighting against corruption, and the justice sector is corrupt and very weak. Businesses are not required on their own to fight against corruption because corruption is the responsibility of all the sectors of a particular country. The national integrity system of a particular country, that is, all the institutions and all the practices that allow to control corruption in a particular country, are made up of the executive sector, the civil society, the judiciary, and business is one of those pillars. In order to effectively fight against corruption, all the pillars of the national integrity system, that is all the institutions and all the practices to fight against corruption, need to be strong in order to make it possible for corruption to be tackled. One has to take a holistic approach to the fight against corruption. It's not only business who have to go on their own against corruption. It's all the sectors of the society that have to do that at once. So Those are a few remarks that I had to make on corruption. I was also asked to reflect very quickly on some of the presentations that have been made.
We're out of time.
Okay, so I will leave that for further responses and discussions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm going to go straight to the floor, and then we'll take a first set of questions or comments, and then we'll come back to the speakers, and we'll have several rounds, I think. Let's collect a few.
Thank you. Little sense I got is that we have three kinds of crises or three kinds of, say, uncertainties, and we also have three kind of actors. But my sense is also that the wrong actors kind of address the wrong questions. The three actors are obviously the big four companies, the big NGOs, I suppose, and the state. The three uncertainties are first, what I understood is that the first uncertainty is the uncertainty in terms of currency exchange, right, which has an impact on the inputs, cost of inputs. And I didn't hear in the presentation by Nestlé that the big four, or Nestlé in particular, is trying to integrate and to compensate for the fluctuations and uncertainties in terms of inputs, like fertilizers and so on. The second kind of crisis is in terms of exchange, and here it seems that the NGOs are trying to work on that. But I believe that it's quite difficult to have fair trade in a trade which is so dominated by large markets. And again, we didn't hear so much about forms of stabilization of market prices by either from the presentation from the company nor from the government. And I know that it's not so longer, no longer so fashionable. Sorry. To have a market stabilization by government, but it worked for textile for 30 years with a group of 77. And if at all, it's no longer fashionable. Again, in an oligopoly structure, the big four, if they're really serious about stabilizing the market, could do something about that. Now, the last thing is about quality. Again, uncertainty in quality. I think it's an outcome of the first two uncertainties. It hurts directly the producers, but it hurts also directly the state. Here, maybe the action of NGOs in diversifying the activity of the producers must be better. And what about the role of the state? Well, it seems to be complex. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, here in front first.
Thank you. One of the complaints that is sometimes leveled against fair trade is that it takes a certain level of sophistication in a cooperative or a level of political access in order to get the fair trade certification in the first place. In other words, the richest coffee growers tend to be able to access the mechanisms by which they can get certification. Can I ask Hilary, please, particularly, how do you go about selecting the cooperatives or the unions with which you work? And a second question, what proportion of Nestlé's total coffee purchases in 1 year is represented by fair trade? Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take two more, and then I'll come back to everybody. But Elliot.
Hi. I was kind of, I liked all four presentations, but I'm quite amazed that none of you actually mentioned the real reasons why, number one, coffee prices have been so low the last decade and a half, and number two, why they've been so volatile, namely the breakup of the International Coffee Agreement in 1989, which was, again, begun in the 1960s and ended at the end of the Cold War at the behest of the U.S., and of course, and my specialization being Uganda, which produces a huge amount of Robusta coffee, and Robusta coffee prices had a huge spike in 1994 due to a bad frost in Brazil, and then thereafter had a huge crash. And you see huge fluctuations going on because of the lack of international agreement on coffee prices. And I question what any of you four could say to the possibility of recreating some sort of agreement, or at least some sort of international quota system, which would stabilize prices for producers across the world.
Thank you. And I'm making you run around. No, over here. I'm going to come all the way over here. Yeah, Deborah, please. Oh, there's another mic there. I'm sorry.
I just want to speak to the wider issue of sort of corporate social responsibility, which no one was terribly critical of, and I'm actually surprised that my colleague, I work with a coalition of NGOs campaigning for legal accountability of companies, and I'm a former Destin student. But I'm surprised that my colleague from Oxfam wasn't very critical about some of what I would perceive to be basically public relations initiatives. With this type of scenario, what we're doing is we're leaving social responsibility up to a few very powerful players who lack any accountability. Now, these private actors define their own voluntary standards, and Hillary listed off a whole host of them about in terms of what is sustainability without any international oversight mechanism, without, you know, we can't tell what consultation there was at the grassroots in defining what those standards would be, while basically gaining tremendous public relations advantage. And what you may be interested in knowing is that there are some colleagues of Hillary's from her public relations company in the audience today. This is very much a public relations exercise to a large extent, and allow me to sit on my hobby horse here. So they gain tremendous advantage out of an investment that, as far as I'm aware, represents a tiny, tiny fraction of an investment across Nestle's product line overall, convincing those of us that are consumers that, in fact, the market is working well. Now, one of the outcomes of this is that incredibly, once again, incredibly private, incredibly powerful players at the retail end, when you and I go to the supermarket to purchase it, to be an active, ethical consumer, we don't necessarily distinguish between one fair trade brand and another because we see the fair trade label and we have trust in that. What we don't recognize is that these big players also bully smaller players out of the market at the retail end, because of their strong relationship with the supermarket sector. So you get into even more of the cycles that Constantine started to introduce when we start to leave, primarily, I would say, social responsibility up to a host of small private actors, well, very large private actors, but a small handful. So there are a couple of questions that emerge from this. One is, what would Nestle say to signing up to something like the UN norms on business and human rights, an international set of standards, recognizing that there is a responsibility for private actors to deal with everything from corruption to economies and so on. I suppose that's the main question, and I'm curious to know actually from Constantine as well what Oxfam's position is in terms of how you toe the line between giving business credit in areas whilst hopefully challenging them to be much more effective and not use public relations for gain and competitive advantage.
Thanks very much. Let's go back to the speakers, and then we'll come back to the floor. Hillary, yes? Yeah, go ahead.
There were a couple of the questions looked at the need to stabilize the market price. Sorry, is this on? Sorry. Yeah, a couple of questions talked about the need to stabilise the market price, which I would quite agree on. And I think it's just because we haven't had much time in our presentations today to have gone through the background to the coffee crisis, one of the main factors of which was the collapse of the economic clauses in the International Coffee Agreement, which had set price bans. And certainly the problems of fluctuating coffee prices requires, I think, a range of solutions, of which you can do some things on farm with farmers, but there certainly needs to be bigger issues addressed at an international level. And I know our company has certainly called for the economic clauses to be put back, also has campaigned for there's a mechanism called Stabex, which was felt to be quite helpful. Just about Nestle's role in this, we are the largest purchaser of coffee, probably accounting for around 10% or so of all coffee production. But as you will know, coffee is a very heavily traded commodity. So the total sort of Nestle transactions in terms of the coffee market only amount to a couple of percent. It's actually very small. Having said that, we recognise our responsibilities. We do believe the sustainable approach is actually very important because that is one way in which you can help to address these issues of supply and demand, because, of course, the other factor in the collapse of prices was the fact that Brazil has a stream of coffee at at sort of low prices, and also Vietnam planted a lot of coffee trees and did that very efficiently, and a lot of their coffee came onto the market, so there was basically an oversupply situation. Looking at the question that asked about fair trade certification taking a level of sophistication, I would agree with that, actually, because we have been involved in helping four cooperatives in El Salvador actually become fair trade certified. It is the co-ops who are certified. We are not certified. It's the producers who have to be certified. And certainly if you're coming to it for the first time, you know, there are quite a lot of things to go through. And there are some costs involved. It's not high costs, but there are some costs involved. And in this case, we actually paid that. And I felt personally that it might have been helpful for there to be some form of advice, and a sort of a fair trade advisory person to work with the farmers. But we sorted it out. So that there maybe is something in that fair trade could look at. In terms of how we actually selected co-ops, certainly in Ethiopia, when we first started our project, we actually wanted to work directly with very small farmers, and we actually selected a geographic location, a small washing station that we knew it was quite small, and we knew there was it had a good supply of sort of local farmers in the area and wouldn't attract too many middlemen, because we didn't want to particularly be working with the middlemen. We wanted to work directly with the farmers. But in terms of the Oromia cooperative, that was a cooperative that's well run. It offers the coffee at the quality that we need, so that's how we came to that choice. Sorry, just very quickly here, turning to the question about this is very much a PR exercise. I know that some people hold that opinion. Obviously, people have to judge for themselves, but I can certainly say that we have spent a very long time planning this. This was not something that we produced overnight. We have been working on this for several years. We have been talking to the Fair Trade Foundation for several years. We then started discussing these particular work in El Salvador and Ethiopia with them 2 years ago. So there would have been a lot easier ways of doing PR stunts. The project is being launched for success. It's launched first in the UK and in October. Already we have announced that it will be launched in Ireland, and there will also be a fair trade product in Sweden. So there's very much a commitment to making this work. And yes, it is small in terms of our global operations, but what we are doing is applying the sustainable approach. And the sustainable approach is based on agreed criteria, which are available for people to have a look at. So the SAA platform, all the indicators are published. Nestle is also a member of the Sustainable Coffee Partnership, which is a UN body. So we certainly have signed up to international, you know, norms on sustainability, and believe that actually we are playing a leading role in that approach. And finally, would we sign the... that we bully the smaller players out the market. I would say that is very much not what we want to do. And in fact, in terms of the branding for Nescafe Partners Blend, we have deliberately taken something that is targeting the mainstream Nescafe consumer, who will not be purchasing currently a fair trade product. So we really don't want to target people who are already buying some of the existing fair trade brands. Would we sign the UN norms on business and human rights? Well, we're signatories of the UN Global Compact. I'm afraid I would have to check with our head office in Bevey about this particular one, but we certainly are signatories of the Global Compact. Sorry if I've missed something. Apologies.
Yeah, that question over there, what percentage of Nestle's overall coffee sourcing is sourced from fair trade?
Well, it's extremely small. I don't know the percentage off the top of my head. I can say that we have just launched in the UK. We have other markets that want to come on board. But it is a small step, but we are sourcing from these particular projects, and we have to also help those projects expand, and we have to see how the consumer reacts. So it is small, I accept that.
It's like,
I don't know.
I think the arithmetic of that is quite easy, because I understand that there is a kind of pilot project with a specific cooperative. It's Oromia. Oromia is very large, 40,000, 70,000 producers. but they managed to produce very, very small, let's say, amount of fair trade coffee. And that's the coffee that is going into that pilot project known as Partners Blend. So it's quite small. In relation with price and the possibility, let's say, to stabilize the market, is very important. I want to remark the importance of understanding that there are two completely, it's like a kind of schizophrenic behavior of the market. And one is the what you have in the market of coffee beans and what happens in beverages, and are completely different in nature and in reality. When you see price for the coffee beans, price has been falling all the time, and it didn't happen with beverages and with what you buy in the supermarket. All the time has increased. Where the difference is going to? And that's an important question if we are talking about sustainability. Sustainability for whom? We have evaluated that as it is, there will be no possibility to stabilize price because there is a very strong motor behind, and that is poverty. What is happening in Ethiopia, what is happening in El Salvador, what is happening in Colombia, is that in general terms, poverty is growing, inequality is growing, and the only possibility to generate some income, which is legal, is through coffee. And normally, in Colombia, I'm from Colombia, in Peru, I'm not from Ethiopia, but normally what people do to survive is to practice what is called intercropping, I think. And that is intercropping with coca, or with poppies, or with cat. But the families need to survive. So, and then you have the market completely distorted in terms of thinking that it's possible to stabilize price. Is free market, would be free market, would be possibility to define the price by the market if there were many actors. But we have four important actors buying coffee. And they monopolize. So if I understand well, I am not an economist, but we are more or less in a situation known as monopsony. And there are very few key players, big players, who can define in reality the price. One last comment in relation with price. The price as it is, be it fair trade, I'm very proud every morning when I drink coffee and it is fair trade, but be it fair trade, the price is not internalizing the key factor for sustainability. In the case of fair trade, perhaps the so-called social sustainability is considered. But environmental and economic sustainability, no way. And that has been the result of a big exercise that Hillary mentioned, known as the 4C. Oxfam is part of this multi-stakeholder initiative. Try to understand what does it mean, what would it mean, sustainability, in this context. And what the reality is that we are drinking very good coffee to the expense of the soil, of the environment, of the economy, and of the stability of communities who depend from coffee. In relation with social responsibility, I think it's a very good question. For us, we think it, for us, when I'm saying us, is Oxfam, is working with partners, we understand that it's something. It's a policy that shouldn't be part like a department of a company, but should be a principle, should be a policy applicable to the whole operation. And then we go into trouble when we analyze, and that's the research we have done in the case of Brazil, in the case of El Salvador and Mexico. We go into trouble with labor practices, with what happens with the needs of capital in order to be productive. And then we discover at the end, and this was at the core with the Rush I forgot to mention, at the core of the loops in the right side of the slide, at the core is the shareholder value, the amount of money that you have to pay as a company to shareholders who they don't care about what happens with the producer. What they need is that the bank account reflects 1.2 or 6% or whatever profit, and that's it. So, and what is enough for that rate of profitability? Who can define that? If that is not defined, there is no possibility, let's say, for stability in prices, for fair trade, or for internalizing the costs for sustainability.
I wonder, Dr. Tay, if you just, I want to get back to the floor soon, but do you have anything to say about the International Coffee Agreement or any replacement of it?
I don't think I have a lot of new things to add to this, but just two points. One, in terms of the contribution of the companies to those farmers in Ethiopia, I think it has to be really put in perspective that the number of farmers who are helped by this is very small. Yeah. They are localized small farmers. A company might come, like Starbucks or some companies, they might come, they build some sanitation or water pipes and so on, which is a good start, but it's not, we should really put it in perspective. It's relative to the number of farmers engaged in that production, it's a very small percentage. Therefore, it's not really adding very much. It's a good start, but it's not really very much. Therefore, I think the question that how much of it is PR, how much of it is really a substantial contribution has to be put in perspective. A second question, which was interesting, is in terms of the price stabilization mechanism. Yes, but I think we have to know this is a commodity where the buyers and sellers are completely in a different, in terms of the your standard demand and supply diagrams, they are completely in a different setup, in the sense that you have a commodity which is nature determined in terms of its supply, which has a huge fluctuation. On the other hand, you have buyers, which you can characterize them as monopsony or whatever you want to call them, but it is not a free market as where you have competition and so on. And therefore, that price stabilization, on the other hand, you have farmers which have to care about their survival for today, but on the other hand, companies who could take their time, and with the fluctuation in prices, they have the storage, the processing mechanism, and so on, and they could really choose when they want to buy and sell. And therefore, the market is not your smooth curve where you can have that allocation process effectively and competitively. That's really the main problem. That's what happens. Coffee prices would come down or up. It all depends what happens to Brazil, whether there is frost or there isn't. And therefore, Ethiopian coffee may go up because Brazil or Vietnam are not selling very lots of it. Otherwise, it will go down. Therefore, the supply curve is of a different nature. Therefore, price stabilization is very weak, especially in an economy like Ethiopia, where you don't have the facilities or the capacity to really choose when you are selling and relative to the production. Therefore, you could really stabilize that market, especially in small economies. Just another small point. Even to get a certification that coffee is organic, it's a long process. It's not as simple as that. Forget about the other mechanisms, but you have to pay or hire with a huge amount of money to get the certification that it's organic. So it's not a simple problem because, well, companies, they will decide whether that's organic or not. They blend it, especially with the new changes, this blending process, they may have an advantage not to characterize it as organic and so on. Therefore, it's not as simple as that in terms of getting that certification process. To the ICO, I don't have any specific comment. It would have helped, but I am not particularly in favor of cartels of any form. Therefore, I don't know how that would apply to for coffee. It would have helped a bit, but it may not be a permanent solution.
Okay, thank you. Briefly, Dr. Kofi.
Could I? I'd like to comment on the issue you raised about the lack of oversight mechanisms in all these schemes that have been launched and are being bandied around the world. There are so many of them to begin with. There's a multiplicity of codes
I told you about the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, Publish What You Pay, the UN Global Compact, the OECD Guidelines for Multinational Enterprises, and now we have the UN Convention Against Corruption. There's no oversight mechanism, as you said, and that's really a matter of concern. And also, all of these schemes are voluntary. None of them is mandatory. Organizations, coalitions like the Publish What You Pay Coalition have been fighting to make the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative mandatory. And punitive measures have to be provided for those companies that don't abide by the rules to which they sign up. But it's really a matter of concern that all of these schemes are just voluntary, no oversight mechanism, no punitive measures. Transparency International last year carried out an evaluation of the implementation of the OECD Convention against bribery of foreign officials. And it appeared very clearly that most of the OECD countries are not taking the steps that are provided in the convention to investigate those companies that have been cited for bribery outside their own countries. And another very worrying development, which shows the lack of commitment on the parts of the developed countries in fighting some of the ills like corruption, is the UN Convention Against Corruption, which to begin with was very difficult to negotiate. The version that finally came out was very weak. But in spite of that, when the convention came into force last December, 30 countries had ratified the convention. And out of the 30, 18 countries were African. Because as you can remember, a lot of pressure was put on African countries last year to show that they're serious about good governance. So 18 of them, and none of the OECD countries in which most of the multinationals are based ratified the convention at the time when it came out, when it came into force, except France. And that tells you about the commitment that the developed countries have in correcting the ills that developing countries suffer from.
Very good. Thank you. Let me go back to the floor now. And I just want to see, show of hands, here in the front. Are there questions up there? In the peanut gallery? No? Yeah.
Hi, I'm not sure as to how the coffee market is right now, but as far as in the UK and in a lot of other countries, how much has this Nestle's market share declined due to the growth and the popularity of companies such as Starbucks and Nero, and how much of this product line, this fair trade product line, is how much of it is a strategic response in order to integrate some sort of premium type of blend, enter into a niche market, and sort of get revenue from that sort of source? I mean, is this on your side of affairs and not considering sort of the PR type of campaign? Thank you.
Okay. Andrew, in the back there.
Hi. Is this working?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to draw off the, sorry, I forgot all the names, but the presentation from Oxfam. It's because your reference to the monopsonistic character of the market, or maybe what you call it is the oligopsonistic character of the market. What strikes me about that with, I mean, I want to direct two questions, one to the Nestle woman, and back to the Oxfam, is that, well, first with the Oxfam, what always strikes me with the fair trade issue is that it's precisely not addressing that issue of how do the producer countries I mean, you're dealing with, you know, you're typically dealing with this extremely competitive producer, and then the next stage up is extremely oligopsonistic, as you say. So the real issue for capturing the value added of coffee production is to move up into that value chain, right? And to me, it always seems that the fair trade issue is not really addressing that. And in the same sense with Nestle, I mean, the project you described is again concentrating at that lower end of production, whereas perhaps the most effective thing would be to train producer countries to develop companies that could then compete with Nestle or something like that. And I mean, that's the irony actually with the fair, because again, so, forgot your name, sorry, but the Nestle woman, is the irony
Hillary
with your
Parsons.
Argument towards the fair, sorry?
Hillary Parsons.
Okay, thanks. The argument then put forward, the trade liberalization, has this irony in it, in the sense that the trade liberalization within this type of very segmented market is precisely driving, I mean, I think, as you rightly say, prices collapsed, partly because of the collapse in the coffee agreement, but also partly because throughout the 80s and 90s, there was this huge push for developing countries to move into export orientation. And yet, they were told, you know, you're not allowed to sort of have industry protection and things like that. Therefore, push into your agricultural commodities, which was precisely the factors that led to an oversupply in the market, to the advantage of companies like Nestle, right?
Okay. Thanks. I'm going to turn back to the panel. Yeah, Hillary.
In terms of the how the market is going, not sure of the global statistics, but certainly the UK domestic instant coffee market is not showing particular growth. If you look at, but the reasons are not just to do with growth of out of home chains like Starbucks. There's a lot of competition from other types of drinks. So you know the Nescafe product or instant coffee that we sell does not really directly compete with a Starbucks, but it is correct that the market is declining. In some other countries, however, I think I'm right in saying that Russia, for example, is a growing market, and there are other, perhaps developing world countries where the market for instant coffee and coffee is growing. Is this an attempt just to get revenue, if I understood the question correctly? Certainly on the fair trade product, we actually make slightly less profit because the investment is higher. So it's not a question of somehow getting extra revenue through charging a higher price, because we actually make slightly less profit on it. In terms of farmers needing to move up the value chain, I think it's correct that there are a range of approaches that farmers can take, and it really depends on what size their farm is and what options are open to them. And one option is to perhaps move to a more premium or speciality type of coffee bean, for which you can get a much higher price. Also, the reason that we've concentrated, however, in this particular project on the lower end, as it was described, is that we really wanted to do something with the smallest farmers, who are the ones that probably have, you know, perhaps most difficulty. They have the least flexibility in terms of perhaps coping in this difficult marketplace. So we really wanted to work with this sustainable approach to find out what would work and for them to help this particular group of farmers. But certainly there are other groups of farmers, and there do need to be other approaches. This is not one approach that we would say should be rolled out universally. It's something that's geared to this particular group of farmers. I would agree that if developing world countries can have their own production, that certainly does help them retain more value, and that certainly in the EU, I think there is like a you pay extra if you were going to import, say, finished coffee into Europe, and yet there's no tariff on the import of raw coffee beans. And certainly our company has been quite active in campaigning and calling for, you know, these types of distortions to end, so that there is a better base from which developing world farmers in particular can work from. So we think that should be addressed.
Would you welcome Ethiopia becoming an instant coffee producer?
Yes. I think that they seem to prefer roast and ground from what I can see. So.
Constantino.
Let's see, very quickly. I think Very recently, it was October, November, there was the second World Coffee Conference. Researchers, companies, everyone was there, and there are predictions on the, let's say, growth of the market, very clearly around 2%, 3% per year for the coming 6 to 10 years. What we have seen as Oxfam, let's say, watching what happens with fair trade, is that predictions indicated that fair trade was supposed to reach kind of a ceiling like 2-3 years ago. The reality is that it keeps growing at an impressive rate, and now the records in terms of growth rate are in the U.S. And we think that has a lot to do with the failure in the negotiations in relation with the WTO. And what happens with consumers like, I don't know, perhaps most of us here, when we see that there is no mechanism for being fair, people decide to go on their own individually and buy the pound or 2 pounds of fair trade or organic, because it will reflect it somehow in defending people, defending environment. So something is happening on that field because of the lack of achievement in terms of regulating trade overall. The reality is that the figures indicate that the fair trade is growing independent if Flow has certified or not companies, because the amount of coffee being certified for the big companies is very, very small when you compare with what is already there by the, let's say, developed by the co-ops. Second element I want to mention very clearly is, has to do with tariffs. I don't think it is so easy that Ethiopia will become a producer, because what we have seen happening in most of the developing countries in Central America is that the opposite is happening. And the bigger, let's say, processing plants have moved to middle-income countries like Mexico or Brazil. And when you go to the web page of the bigger companies, you will see that those countries are the ones who are concentrating. And that has to do a lot with the possibility to produce in those countries and to export to non-European Union countries. And why? Because the problem with tariffs in the European Union is a real problem for developing countries willing to export because of the tariffs existing. Mm-hmm. So an important reform should happen at that level. Perhaps a final comment related with the several questions has to do with the International Coffee Agreement. The International Coffee Agreement, existing till 1989, had a lot of critiques because it was assigning quotas to different producer countries, etc. The U.S. left the ICO at that time. And what we see in terms of price fluctuations and price fall is permanent. All the time, more countries independently going into the market and the price falling all the time. During the last 2-3 years, countries, companies, different actors have been repositioning in relation with the International Coffee Agreement that will be renegotiated this year. At the end of this month, in the ICO, very close, I think near here, will take place meetings in relation with setting an agenda for negotiating this International Coffee Agreement. And it should be regulating what will happen from 2007 till 2012, I think. At the core of the negotiations is the concept of sustainability. And for organizations like Oxfam, sustainability would have to do with recognizing possibilities for poorest producers, people representing co-ops, people representing the lowest extreme in the chain, to be participating with a, let's say, real voice in the definition of this International Coffee Agreement. As it is now, there is a private sector board, consultative board, and governments, and they are the ones who are defining. And that's no problem with that. The problem is that the producers are not really represented there. And they respond, they are responding for more than 75% of the whole market. And they have no voice.
No.
No more comment, Dr. Cody? Any more comment? Okay. We've just about reached the end of our time. Did you have a final word that you wanted to say, Hilary?
I've just been doing a quick calculation, seeing as everyone's pressing me on figures.
Right.
And I've worked out that in Ethiopia, we're currently buying either from the project that we're trying to get certified or from the Fair Trade Co-op, that well over 10% of our purchases from Ethiopia are already at the Fair Trade prices. So hopefully that shows the level of our commitment.
Okay. Well, I think we all now know a little bit more what to look for when we go for our cup of coffee. And I want to thank all the speakers and those who came from afar as well to take the time to come and talk to us and present these views. And we'll be following very closely to see, you know, those shares of fair trade coffee vastly increasing in the among the four top coffee companies internationally. Thank you very much.